Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, and Merry Christmas as the Christmas season continues. I hope it's a Merry Christmas season for you. Maybe you got a white Christmas where you are. We didn't get a white Christmas where I am here in San Diego, and I'm pretty sure they didn't get a white Christmas in Louisiana where our guest Michael Lofton is. You did not have a white Christmas, did you?
Haven't had a white Christmas in a while, actually.
Yeah. You guys get that the Gulf of Mexico weather, right? So you stay pretty warm almost all the time.
Yeah, right now I have the AC on. So
that is so don't tell people that. Like, people in Minnesota are like, shut up, Michael.
I'll trade you.
Yeah. Well, one of the nice things here in Southern California is in this week after Christmas, people come from snowy places to come on vacation, which is always nice. It's always nice to see the people visiting, but it's funny because they go to the beach, and there's nobody in Southern California who goes to the beach in December.
Right.
No. Well, surfers do, but it's surfers and people from Minnesota. That's the only people on the beach. December in San Diego. And they're like, wow, the water's cold. Yeah, the water's always cold here. It's not like the Gulf of Mexico. Anyways, welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We're really happy to have you. Affiliate apologist with Catholic Answers. And I hope that's an affiliation that will be long running. And you're the proprietor of Reason and Theology. How long have you been doing Reason and Theology? I forgot to ask you that last hour. How long have you been doing it?
4 years. Mm-hmm. In January, it'll be 4 years, yeah.
And you don't shy away from taking, I mean, you're not, I don't think, seeking contentious issues, but you don't shy away from it. And you do it live, right?
Yeah, I do almost all of my episodes live. And no, I don't seek out contentious issues, but they seem to find me. And it seems that they're not commented on often. So the lot, you know, falls to me in some cases, unfortunately. So
yeah.
So I address them.
So you'll be doing the show and you're maybe talking about a topic, and then you can kind of see the feed of questions and comments while you're talking, or no? You can?
Yeah. Yeah, I see the feed, and I'll read questions from there and answer them, or I'll talk about something and I can see their feedback, and I might incorporate some of the things that I'm seeing in there. Which is actually helpful because sometimes my audio has been off and I was just talking to nobody. And so they're all saying, no sound, no audio, no sound. So you got to pay attention.
That's funny. You're just.
In fact, I did a show for 30 minutes with no audio because I wasn't paying attention to the chat. I finally pulled it up and everybody was just dying saying, no audio. People were calling me, everything. So.
You know, the audio is never out when you're doing a terrible show either. The audio is only out when you're like, oh, I am killing it today. I am smoking. This is going so well. I mean, no one has heard you for the last 30 minutes.
Which in that case, I had to stop the show and start it over and go over everything that I went over in that first 30 minutes. Yeah. No? Good times.
Maybe there was a reason for that. Maybe you were better the second time.
And maybe, I don't know.
So, but I love the fact that it took you 30 minutes to notice that people were shouting at you. There's no sound.
And that's rare because I'm usually checking the chat. But on that day, I decided I'm not. And it happened to be the one day that my sound wasn't working.
And do the people argue with each other? Like somebody will say something, and somebody will go, no, that's not what Michael said. And then somebody else, that all happens?
Yeah. Yeah, that goes on, or they'll have a debate on something that's not related to the show. But anytime if I see that they're debating on what I said, I'll try to address that in the stream so that I'm accounting for how people are receiving what I'm saying.
Uh-huh.
It tries to help. I try to help. It somewhat does. Yeah. When you're doing things live, you don't really know what the feedback is like, so...
I don't know what this says about Catholic Answers Live, but in our internet feeds while the show is going on, which usually I can't watch, but when I can watch them, if people are watching on Facebook or YouTube, if you read the feed, you wouldn't even know that there's a show going on. They're talking about things that have nothing to do with it's weird. On Facebook, they're discussing what everyone's making for dinner because they're all friends and it's a lovely community. Over on YouTube, where everyone hates each other. they're all accusing each other of heresy and of, you know, it's a friend of mine calls it Catholic Hunger Games over there on YouTube. And I mean, I'm like, if I look in, it makes me feel sad because I think, you know, we're doing a show here. Like, there right. is, I yeah. think it's kind of an interesting show, but no, nothing. And right now they're not even noticing that I'm saying this about them. They're still right. arguing about, right. You know, chicken cordon bleu over on Facebook,
right.
and then how you're supposed to cook that, and then over on YouTube they're burning heretics at the internet
at
stake.
The online stake. Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right. We're doing a show here. I almost gave out the phone number, but I'm not going to give out the phone number because Michael Lofton is our guest, and we've got questions from his patrons from Reason and Theology. And here's another one for you, Michael. I've heard a lot of Protestants complain about spiritual, quote, dryness. Do you think this is comparable to the dark night of the soul, a problem due to an impoverished Protestant spirituality, or something else?
Yeah, it's hard to say because every person's different and they're going to have different situations. But just, I guess, broadly speaking, I think when a Protestant experiences dryness, it's going to be very similar to how maybe when a Catholic experienced dryness. And I would say neither one of those would ordinarily be the dark night of the soul that that we see St. John referring to. I'm not an expert in it. I have read his book on it, but it has been a while. What I can say this is when he speaks of the dark night of the soul, that is St. John, he's referring to a state that of a holy person may go through where they feel they feel that God is distant from them. But you'll notice the context of this state is after they've already purged a lot of the sins of the flesh and of the senses. And so they've already experienced a great deal of purgation and sanctity by the time you reach that level. And I just don't know if that speaks to most of us who haven't reached that level, yeah. Catholic or Protestant. So I think when we experience dryness, it's probably not the dark night of the soul that he's referring to. As far as Protestants, I do think that it would be very harder for them to reach that point of the dark night of the soul where they've already purged a lot of the sins that have already been purged by that time. I think it would be a lot harder for them to do without the sacraments. They do have baptism. They do have that sacrament they can draw on, but they don't have confession. They don't have confirmation. They tend to not have the Eucharist. Again, painting with a broad brush here, most Protestants don't have all of the sacraments. So I think it's a lot harder for them to reach that state. So when I hear maybe of a Protestant experiencing that dryness, I think it's highly unlikely that it's the dark night of the soul. However, it is possible for somebody who has not formally come into the union with the Catholic Church to be informally united to it, such as a Protestant. But I think that those are extraordinary circumstances.
I'm so glad to hear you mention the sacraments because it does seem like Catholics we devalue the sacraments. We do not realize that. Do you want to make progress in the moral and spiritual life? The sacraments are the ultimate power up. I don't know to use a video game analogy, but I mean the sacraments have genuine power. Not to just take away your free will but to work through your human nature in mysterious ways that bring you to the fullness of life.
To use a video game analogy, can you beat Mario just as little tiny Mario without the mushroom, without the flower? Can you beat it?
Yeah.
Maybe, but it's a lot harder. The sacraments are like that mushroom and the fire flower, right?
Guess who played video games in the 90s? Yeah.
Right.
It really, like, how old are you? Mario mushroom.
I dated myself there. But you know what? Mario is popular now. Old Mario games we grew up, I grew up with. They're popular today, even.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's the classics, right?
They're the classics.
I make fun of you for that, but when I was a kid, I think maybe junior high age, my grandparents bought my brothers and sisters and I a really special Christmas present, and we loved it. And it was a game called Pong. And
was it on Atari?
It was, I don't know. It was just called Pong. I don't know. And you hooked it up to your TV and then you had to go back and read the directions 40 times to hook it up correctly to your TV. And then you turned to some channel and then you could play Pong, which was two lines on a, and a dot on a screen. That's all it was. And we
I think that was the first video game, right?
Yeah. That was the first one I ever knew of. And it was mesmerizing to us. Mesmerizing. And all the sound effects were this. Boop. That's it. Right. That's the whole palette of sounds that were available to you.
Yeah.
Boop.
I played it on Atari. I remember that. We both dated ourselves here.
All right, we gotta take a break. We'll be right back with more questions for Michael Lofton from Reason and Theology.
Your questions, Catholic Answers, live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
It is a tremendous privilege to be able to speak to so many of you and to know that so many of you are listening to the answers which we want to give you so that you can know the truth of Jesus and come to love him more.
EWTN Open Line Wednesday with Father Mitch Pacwa tomorrow afternoon, 3 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
By the way, when you played Pong, you know, this was before TVs had anywhere. You couldn't plug anything into your TV. There was no plug-in. That didn't exist.
How did you connect it?
You had to undo the screws for the UHF antenna. And then you took the UHF. I don't remember if you had to take the UHF antenna off, which was the round antenna. The sticky uppy antenna was the VHF. And the UHF was the round antenna. And then you took these two little like U-shaped contacts. You know, you put them under the screw, screwed the screw down. And now you could play Pong on your TV. But there was no input to a TV. Like the back of my TV now, I don't understand what's going on in the back of my TV. I don't know what most of that is for. It's probably the government monitoring me. I'm fairly certain of that. I don't know what all that stuff is. I assume it's National Security Administration equipment that they need to monitor my behavior. And I hope I'm doing well in the government's eyes, but I don't know what it's for.
Sounds to me that sounds perfectly reasonable. Yeah.
I'm glad you thank you for joining me in my TV conspiracy theory. Do you know my wife and I went to buy a TV at the guy? We were like, we don't want a smart TV. And he's like, they're all smart TVs. Like everything's a smart TV now. I said, I don't want a smart TV. And my wife didn't care. It was me. I don't want a smart TV. And he goes, could you just tell me why you don't want a smart TV? I said, I don't want anything with a microphone on it in my house. And he goes, that's not what a smart TV is. It doesn't have a microphone. That a smart TV is like, it has like Roku on it. You know, it's like, it's got computer stuff on it. I was like, all right. I'll take a smart TV. How much is it? And they're like, you know, now it's like a 50-inch TV for $43. They're incredibly inexpensive for these crazy TVs. But I was all Mr. Paranoid about the smart TV. No, I don't want a smart TV. I want a dumb TV. Where's the dumb TV section? It was please send me over to the dumb TVs. They're like, hey, yeah, this is Best Buy. We don't have a dumb TV section. If you want to go to the Goodwill, you can find the dumb TV section.
Are the dumb TVs, are those the ones that are kind of, you know,
they're thick, flat, yeah.
They're three-dimensional. Yeah.
That's right. I want a TV that can't hang on my wall, that takes up 8 square feet of floor space. That's the TV I'm looking for. You don't have that here at Best Buy? What is wrong with you people? I thought this was a technology store. All right, I'm giving you another question. You ready?
Mm-hmm.
All right, Michael Lofton, our guest. How does one become a Protestant elder contrasted with how one becomes a Catholic elder, a.k.a. bishop?
So by elder, I imagine they mean just regular pastor, because they would make a distinction between their elders and bishops. So, yeah, how does a Protestant usually become an elder? There's different kinds of Protestants, so there's all kinds of methods. I mean, one common one sometimes is just self-appointment. I mean, I'm not joking. There are some people who would just kind of say, well, I read the Bible and, you know, I'm a pastor now. There are some of those. You do have other situations where perhaps a local congregation chooses who somebody is going to be, who is going to be an elder, and they lay hands on them. And then you might have some cases where maybe seminary is required, so you have to go through formal training, and then the congregation will hire you and maybe perhaps lay hands on you. So those tend to be the common methods. Now, we can certainly contrast that with the Catholic Church, where in the Catholic Church, you have to go to seminary for quite a few years. And once you go through seminary, you're ordained a deacon and then a priest. And you'll function as a priest for quite a bit. And what will happen is the Congregation for Bishops, well, actually, now it's called the Dicastery for Bishops in Rome. Whenever there's an opening for a bishop of a diocese or of a territory, the dicastery will look at various priests that are suggested to them in that territory, and they will pick out somebody to be made a bishop. Now, it's a little bit different for Eastern Catholic bishops, but that's how it works for the majority of bishops in the world who are Latin Rite. So in other words, it's incredibly rare to be appointed a bishop in the Catholic Church, whereas it's relatively easy and frequent to be made an elder in the Protestant Church.
All right. Thank you for that question. I forgot to read the ad, so I'm going to read it right now, Darren.
me.
All right. I'm ready to read it. And I got to read it word for word because they told me I got to get this exactly right because it involves a poem and a search and I don't want to mess it up. Each day of Christmas, we'll be reading a clue leading you to a book title at shop.catholic.com. If you're one of the first five to locate the product and use the attached promo code, you will get it for free. Today is the third day of Christmas. Day three, the three French hens. Faith, hope, and love on hearts and pens. Seek and find ye the three French hens. Happy hunting at shop.catholic.com. One more time, faith, hope, and love on hearts and pens. Seek and find ye the three French hens. Mm-hmm. Is a French hen related in any way to a French horn, or is that just a mere kind of...
I'm lost
what
with
is a
the
French
three
hen?
French hens. I don't know. I'm lost here. So.
I never thought about that. Like I've never seen a French hen. I've never.
Yeah.
It's just a hen from France, maybe. I don't know.
Maybe
Or Haiti or certain parts of Canada. I have no idea. All right, here we go. Another question for Michael. Are there any instances where something has been declared a dogmatic fact when later it was discovered to be historically or scientifically wrong? Say the theory of geocentrism, or perhaps somebody declared to be a heretic at a church council who was later discovered not to be. How would we navigate a situation like this? This is right in your wheelhouse, mm-hmm. Michael. This is your kind
it
of question.
Oh, I love this question. It's one one that I've certainly asked. I do think that we're conflating a few things in it. So let me maybe define our terms here. And that will help clear some of the confusion. Well, first of all, what's a dogmatic fact? Let's maybe start there. So we might speak of, first of all, just dogmas. And what we mean by that in the Catholic Church these days is a dogma is something that is in divine revelation. God revealed it, perhaps in sacred scripture. And the church has confirmed it as something revealed by God. So God has revealed it, and the church says it is revealed by God. That's a dogma. A dogmatic fact is a little different. A dogmatic fact is not something that God has revealed, but it is something that is related to something that God has revealed, either historically or logically. So in other words, we might say that let's go with the First Vatican Council. The First Vatican Council is an ecumenical council. We can say that that is a dogmatic fact. The reason why is it's not a dogma because God nowhere said, hey, the First Vatican Council is revealed by me. That never happened. But it does define something that is revealed by God, namely papal infallibility. That is revealed by God. And the book of Matthew, for instance. So we might say Vatican I is not it's not a dogma, but it is a dogmatic fact insofar as you can't deny Vatican I without then denying what it teaches, which is papal infallibility, which is revealed by God. So again, a dogmatic fact, something that is historically related to something in sacred scripture revealed by God. So now that we defined that, we have to ask the question, okay, well, has geocentrism been defined by the church as a dogmatic fact? I would say no. The church has never, in its magisterium, taught geocentrism, certainly not as a dogmatic fact. But I would even say it hasn't taught it in its non-definitive teachings either. So I challenge that. And then the other question was, okay, well, if there was a person at a church council condemned, and then it turns out that that person didn't really believe what he was condemned for, is that an example of a dogmatic fact being reversed? I would say that doesn't fall within the scope of a dogmatic fact, a particular person being condemned at a council. Because whether a particular person is a heretic is not necessarily related to a matter of faith and morals, because that person could not exist, have never existed, and the matter of faith and morals would still be true. So it's not necessarily related. So if an ecumenical council says, hey, Nestorius is a heretic, I would say that's not even a dogmatic fact. And so this isn't even within the scope of the church's infallibility. What is in the church's scope of the church's infallibility is whether Nestorianism is heretical. The teaching.
Ah, yeah.
The church can say if the teaching is heretical, but it's not necessarily infallible in evaluating a particular person. Does that help answer the question? Because there's so much going on with it. I hope that does. What do you think, Si?
Yeah, I think that does answer the question, and I think there's a lot of anxiety about just which things are solid, mm-hmm. and which things are fluid and which things are just gaseous. I went for the full metaphor in church teaching. You know, there's a lot of anxiety about that. Mm.
And so to put it, when you put it like that, what's going to be solid is teachings on faith and morals, or something that's necessary to maintain to preserve those faith and morals, even if it's a matter of science and history or just fact, but only if it's a matter that's necessary to maintain faith and morals. I gave an analogy earlier. Jesus is fully God, fully man. And somebody comes back and says, well, okay, great. I believe that. I just don't believe that Jesus ever existed. Well, wait, that is necessarily related to the matter of faith and morals, because you can't say that Jesus is fully God, fully man if you believe he never existed. How can he be fully man if he never ever existed? That's necessary to maintain the doctrine. But whether so-and-so is a heretic is not necessary to maintain the doctrine that Jesus is fully God, fully man, right?
Yeah.
There's a difference there.
Yeah. Thanks very much for the question. All these questions come from patrons to Michael Lofton's podcast, Reason and Theology. And many of the questions are posted during the show, which Michael often records live, and he'll check the feed and see a question there. And he collected up a bunch of these ones, particularly from his patrons for us, so we could do this show with him. And this next one, how did the church determine who the true pope was during the time that there were multiple claimants to the papacy? And how do we know that the church got it right?
Yeah, this is a tough one, because there were some periods in history where word did not travel very quickly. So mm-hmm. prior to the printing press, there could be some confusion in this area, and they got sorted out in all kinds of ways. Sometimes you had the emperor intervening. There's just all kinds of stuff. Sometimes the people in the city of Rome intervened, all sorts of situations. But since the time of the printing press, and where we have also the College of Cardinals that can verify who they elected, it's a lot harder for this scenario to happen, especially in light of the fact that we have that notion that I spoke of earlier, the universal and peaceful acceptance. So how can we determine at this point who is a pope, who is an anti-pope? We can say, okay, who did the College of Cardinals elect? And if there's a little bit of confusion on that, maybe there's questions on whether or not they elected somebody canonical or not. Universal and peaceful acceptance. But that's for now. again, throughout history, it just varied according to situation because there were all kinds of issues going on, especially in the first millennium.
All kinds of issues of because of the communication stuff or just because...
Communication and also no cardinals.
Right.
There wasn't the College of Cardinals yet. So sometimes it was a little harder to identify who was elected, and maybe somebody was elected and then an emperor came and removed them. And so there's just all kinds of confusion going on.
Right. Emperors, man. Yeah. No end to the trouble with emperors. All right. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back. We've got a bunch more questions for Michael Lofton. And we'll do that right after this on Catholic Answers Live. The recent decision by the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade was a monumental victory for the pro-life movement. But the fight is far from over. With our new booklet, Why We're Pro-Life, we have produced the perfect tool to prepare you to have peaceful and convincing conversations to shed light on the truth about human life from conception to natural death. Catholic Answers is printing millions of copies of this booklet, and we plan simply to give them away. You can help us in two ways. First, by generously supporting this project. 25 cents prints one book. $2,500 prints 10,000, and so on. Second, by helping us distribute the booklet through your parish, your school, or the pro-life ministry you work with. Catholic Answers is going to blanket the country with Why We're Pro-Life, but only if you step up and help us. Thank you so much. For more information, visit whywearepro-life.com.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
As Catholic apologetics have gotten stronger, Protestant responses have gotten stronger as well. And now they have their own answers to rebut the standard Catholic proofs. Don't fret, we've got you covered. In his new book, Meeting the Protestant Response, apologist Carlo Broussard gives well-reasoned biblical answers to Protestant comebacks. Order your copy of Meeting the Protestant Response today at shop.catholic.com or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore.
Dr. David Anders here. Where is purgatory in the Bible? Why confess my sins to a priest?
Find out more tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern on Call to Communion.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Christmas edition. We're doing Christmas editions all this week and part of next week and celebrating Christmas, the 12 days of Christmas, and got sales going on over at shop.catholic.com, little hunts going on each day at shop.catholic.com, and I've got my little Santa hat here. No, it's not a Santa hat. I should say it's a St. Nicholas hat. I've got my St. Nicholas hat on my microphone, and joining us today for a really fun conversation, Michael Lofton, the proprietor of the Reason and Theology podcast, and all the questions for Michael coming from his patrons over there at the podcast. And thank you very much to those patrons because you're keeping really good stuff on the air and available to people. There are folks who are willing to support high quality Catholic media. And again, as we approach the end of the year, we want to just keep saying it over and over. Thank you for supporting those local Catholic radio stations, EWTN, us here at Catholic Answers, all the podcasters like Michael who are doing their great work. It really is. It's extraordinary what the Catholic laity are supporting today, trying to help bring clarity to the world. Don't you think, Michael?
Absolutely. And I'm very, very grateful for everybody who's supporting my podcast and also here Catholic Answers. It's getting the message out there. So thank y'all.
Yeah, getting the message out there in a world that, oh man, is that needed. Yeah. All right, here's another question from one of your patrons. Are the words of institution at Mass, quoting the Gospels, or do the Gospels quote the Mass? What a great question.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm curious to see how you're going to answer this.
Yeah, and for those who might not be familiar, the words of institution refers to, that part during the liturgy where the priest mentions, this is my body, this is my blood. And so that's the words of institution. So I would say that the Gospels are quoting from a pre-existing Mass, because I would say that you already had the Mass prior to the inscripturation of the Gospels. You have the first Mass right there on the night in which Jesus was betrayed. That's what we're quoting whenever the words of institution are saying or said. Again, on the night he was betrayed, he has the Mass there in the Passover liturgy. So that came first. The Gospels, particularly Matthew, is hearkening back to that. Whether it's a word for word quote is something else, because we do see a little bit of variation between what is said in the liturgy, perhaps in the Roman Rite, what's said as far as the words of institution in the Gospel of Matthew, and also the words of institution in 1 Corinthians 11, where Paul goes over the words. They all have a substantial unity, but there's just little tiny variants here and there. But what's curious is in the case of 1 Corinthians 11, Paul talks about how he passes on to the Corinthians what has been handed down to him, and then he gives the words of institution. So it was already something that was handed down to him. 1 Corinthians is written before the Gospel of Matthew, and arguably before Mark. So I would say it's written before any of the Gospels. And he's saying this was already handed down to him. So the words of institution came first, then the Gospels.
It's really something to think about that okay, this is, you think about Paul, what we know about Paul being converted and going to Damascus, that's probably the first time he heard those words.
Maybe
in Damascus or in those early, somebody had to form him.
Mm-hmm.
So that means in the early or mid-30s, well, in the mid-30s AD, mm-hmm. Christians are already being formed by being told, this is what Jesus said on the night that he died. This is what Jesus said.
There was a paradosis, a tradition, a handing down of the faith already before the New Testament was written. A fun fact for you is that there's actually a liturgy, one of the oldest liturgies that we have, the liturgy of Adai and Mari, used in the East Syriac Rite, does not have the words of institution explicitly in it.
Yeah, I know, but
that's what's interesting.
I know that is very interesting, you've talked quite a bit in various answers that you've given today about the words and then the meaning of the words, and so here you have a sense in this early liturgy of actions and words and the meaning of them. And the church has decided what they intend to do in this liturgy is exactly what is done in every other. Yeah.
Yes. The words of institution are there in, if you will, in meaning, but not in any one particular place explicitly, but it's effectively there and communicated. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Here's here's an interesting one. How does the Catholic, there's a word missing here, but how does the Catholic Church view the old Catholic churches and the Polish National Catholic Church?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the old Catholics broke away from the Catholic Church in 1870 by rejecting the First Vatican Council, and I believe the Polish National Catholic Church is an extension of that. So let me maybe just speak more broadly rather than specifically about the Polish National Catholic Church. The old Catholics, we would say that their sacraments are valid, so they have valid bishops, valid ordinations. But we would say that they are in schism. They're not in submission to the Roman pontiff. So they do lack an essential element there, and that is communion with the successor of St. Peter. However, in the case where they have recently begun ordaining women, we would say those women are not validly ordained. So whenever we speak of their valid sacraments, referring specifically to their male bishops and male priests.
Thank you very, very much for that question. I think I'm going to try to get some more in here before we have to go to our final break. I was wondering if you could tell me about the dubia submitted to Pope Francis There were five dubia, I think. And why do you think he is waiting so long to answer, if he even intends on answering? Hasn't it been close to 2 years? Thanks, Michael. I think they're saying thanks, Michael, not thanks, comma, Michael. So I'm assuming that's why I read it that way. But it might have been might be Michael, but go ahead. Sorry, Michael.
I think that he has effectively answered the dubia, because he has approved of certain guidelines and an interpretation of Amoris Laetitia with the Buenos Aires bishops. So I think that effectively answers it. But I would also say the questions that were submitted to him, 4 out of 5 of those questions are irrelevant to Amoris Laetitia. They completely miss the point. They're asking questions about something that is not actually being addressed, or the contrary is not being asserted in the document. So it's completely irrelevant, 4 out of the 5 questions. One question, however, is relevant to the document of Amoris Laetitia. And I would say Amoris Laetitia itself already answers that question. So in other words, I don't see why the dubia was submitted in light of the fact that 4 out of the 5 questions are irrelevant to the document, and then the one that is relevant was already answered. Why was this even submitted? That being said, I do think it would be helpful if Pope Francis went ahead and still addressed it and gave that answer rather than not explicitly answering it. We can say maybe he has indirectly answered it already, but I think it would be helpful to just go ahead and directly answer it and perhaps say what was just said. I do think that Dr. Robert Fastigi has written on the 5 dubia and has given a direct response to every one of those. I highly recommend that y'all check those out. Also, I've done in-depth videos on Amoris Laetitia, including the dubia that you might want to check on my own platform, Reason and Theology.
Thank you very much for that question. We'll take a quick break. Last break, then lots more questions before the end of the show for Michael Lofton, our guest, right after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
St. John Paul II stated that, for the disciple of Christ, evangelization is a duty, an obligation of love. And the Catechism of the Catholic Church states that evangelization is necessary for salvation.
So we know we're called, but how do we do it?
St. Paul Street Evangelization can help. To learn more, contact us at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Each week on The World Over, Raymond Arroyo challenges listeners and viewers with important political and cultural reporting and analysis of a wide variety of topics of interest to Catholics and people of faith. And you can get news from The World Over in your inbox every week. It's easy. Visit EWTN.com and click subscribe. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Michael Lofton, our guest, affiliate apologist here at Catholic Answers and the proprietor of the Reason and Theology podcast, which I have been recommending throughout this program and will continue to recommend. You should check it out. It's very, very good. Lots of great questions, conversations, discussion over there at Reason and Theology. Next question for you, Michael, and I'm just going to get right down to business and make sure we get to everybody if we can. I like this question because it starts with the word also. So I don't, I guess I feel like I'm coming in the middle of a conversation, but all right. Also, you have said the magisterium cannot allow anything harmful, nor can the magisterium not be present at all times so as to not have any point where the faithful are abandoned. And I, of course, agree. But how can that be reconciled with the fact that the Arian heresy seemingly dominated for the brief time until it was condemned in council? What if hypothetically someone was taught Arianism by one of the many bishops and who subscribed to it, but died before it was sorted out in the council? Could someone level this as an argument against the magisterium always being present for Catholics to follow?
It's a great question, but it entirely misunderstands my position. So let me maybe clarify it, and I think that will dispel all the confusion here. I do not maintain that the magisterium can't allow anything harmful, just indiscriminately like that. I have a much more qualified position than that. What I was saying, and what I would continue to defend, is the thesis that the magisterium, when we speak of it universally, a universal organ of the magisterium, the Pope acting as the universal shepherd for all the Christian faithful, or an ecumenical council, the magisterium on that level cannot teach something that is destructive to souls. That's what I was referring to. Now, he brings up the case of a bishop teaching Arianism, perhaps to somebody in his diocese. That's not what I'm referring to, because a bishop teaching on his in his diocese on the local level is not a universal organ in the magisterium. That's just that's, if you will, an individual bishop who has magisterial authority in his diocese, but it's not a universal authority. That lower level of teaching authority, just the individual bishop, is not protected in the same way that a universal organ of the magisterium is protected. So you could have a bishop teaching heresy, and that's certainly destructive and harmful to souls. And yeah, you did have plenty of bishops who taught Arianism early on in the early church, and I would certainly say that's harmful to souls. But did the universal church ever teach Arianism? No. Did an ecumenical council ever teach Arianism? No. Did a pope, as a universal shepherd, ever teach Arianism? No. So that's what I'm referring to. I'm referring to that universal organ. And then also, as far as there's a question in there about indefectibility and perpetuity, that the church will always be essentially what it is, consistent throughout the ages. And he's asking, well, how does that work with the Arian crisis? Well, you could have the case where you have a lot of bishops who are unfaithful. Does that touch on the essence of who the church is? No, because you still have a college of bishops who are faithful, and you can identify them because they're in communion with the Bishop of Rome, the successor of St. Peter. It might be smaller as far as the College of Bishops, and that, at the time of the Arian crisis, it was smaller. And in other ages, it might be bigger. But you still have what the church is essentially and visibly right there. So it's still perpetual. It's still there in every single age. So I don't think the case of the Arian crisis touches on who the church is in its essence, and its indefectibility and perpetuity in any kind of way.
Okay. I appreciate that question and that answer. Could I follow up with something? Because we get a lot of times the example of Arianism, and people will say, you know, like they talk about the trouble today and that we have in the church, and they'll go, you think this is bad? Think about Arianism. So could you give us just a 1 or 2 minute primer on Arianism? I mean, what was it? Because I think there's lots of people who are like, what is this horrible thing that happened to the church that there are, people are always referring to, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah, it was pretty rough. there were literally fights in the street.
Nicholas, correct?
there is that story.
Oh yeah,
it does come much later though.
Apocryphal. Yeah. Okay, fair enough.
It may be, but there were literally fist fights in the street. The average person is fighting over this issue. Okay, well here's what it is. In the early 300s and a little bit prior to that, late 200s, you start to have people who are denying that Jesus is fully God. They want to say that he's a created being. They want to say he's highly elevated by God, but still there was a time in which he was not. And this was really popularized by a figure known as Arius, who was a presbyter, a priest in Alexandria. And he would create these tunes and songs, popular songs, that would carry and transmit this doctrine. So there was a time he was not, referring to Jesus, saying that he's a creative being. He popularized that into music, and the average person was singing this, singing about how Jesus is a creative being. It was creating confusion. It spread just really quickly all over. So there were a lot of people denied the deity of Christ. So it became a huge problem. Obviously, the faithful who were saying, no, Jesus is fully divine, he's not a creative being, there's clashes between them and those who are maintaining Arianism, a denial that Jesus is fully divine. And this creates some instability in the Roman Empire. Well, Constantine, at the time, wants some stability in his empire. So he calls an ecumenical council, the First Council of Nicaea, where the bishops of the world are going to come together. He's going to pay for their trip to come to Nicaea, and they're going to settle the issue. And so they do so. And a lot of the bishops who were in previous eras persecuted by emperors are now brought to Nicaea by the emperor, being praised and lauded by the emperor. Is quite a sight. And in the council, they debate the question of Arianism. Is Jesus fully God? Is he a created being? And the council decided what we have received from the apostles is that Jesus is not a created being. He's fully God. He's of one substance with the Father. The council decided that and said, look, this is the faith that has always been handed down, that has been handed down and always been taught and given to us. But still, there were a lot of people who dissented from Nicaea, and Nicaea even after, and Arianism even after Nicaea really grew. And so there was a ton of Arians out there, even after the first ecumenical council, Nicaea I, had already settled the matter. There's a ton of people still teaching Arianism. And there was just a lot of confusion on terminology and language and debates on scripture. It was chaos. Like I said, there were fistfights in the street with the average person saying, no, he's not a created being, and some saying, yes, he is. And finally, we have some more councils after that helped really digest the first ecumenical council, Nicaea I, and really implement it. And eventually the heresy died out, but it took generations. In fact, you still have Arianism going into the 500s and a little bit later than that in some parts of Europe. And so it took a long time to stamp out the Arian heresy. So it was pervasive. It was nasty, caused a lot of division.
That whole story, thank you so much for that, because that was very, very helpful. And that whole story just confirms me in a prejudice that I have, which is pop music is evil. I'm only kidding. Here's another question for you. A question on polemism. St. Gregory, right? Mm-hmm. Is polemism considered a heresy in the West? I've heard some Eastern Catholics practice it.
Yeah, so some might ask the question, what is polemism? So polemism is still going to affirm, like all other Catholics, that God is what's called simple. God's not made up of parts. We don't believe that God's made up of parts. In that sense, we say he's simple, not that he's simplistic. He's obviously very complex, but he is just one. He's not made up of parts. There's not part of God here and part of God there. That's what we mean by simple. Polemism agrees with the rest of Catholics. Yes, he's simple, but it wants to make a distinction between God's essence and also his activities. So between what God is and how he acts, if you will. Well, there's actually a lot of other ways to define the energies, but we'll just use that as a working definition. So his activities. Well, some might say this distinction, it's a really strong distinction. Others might say, no, it's a very weak distinction. There's a debate there. But the question is, okay, when we speak of this distinction between God's essence and energies, is that within the bounds of Catholicism? The answer is yes, because the Catholic Church has taught solemnly that God is simple, but it doesn't really go into the details of that. So this is still within the bounds and the scope of what the church has defined in God's simplicity. So there's debates in Catholicism on, is Thomas Aquinas's understanding of simplicity right? Or is Duns Scotus's view right? Or is Gregory Palamas's view of simplicity right? There's these intramural debates that take place within Catholicism. And yes, some in Eastern Catholicism hold to polemism. Some hold to Aquinas's view. Some hold to Duns Scotus's view. But it's all within the bounds of orthodoxy. And it's not something that the church has settled yet. So it's still an open debate. It's kind of like the question of, you know, how does free will work with God's sovereignty and predestination? the church hasn't settled that yet. So there's different views that can be debated within Catholic orthodoxy. And so it is with this.
You make it seem like the church hasn't settled everything. Like they're
right. It certainly hasn't settled this one.
I'm very uncomfortable with that. I want everything settled.
it would be nice, but this is a very complex one. This is probably one of the most complex things to engage as any discussion related to the essence and energies distinction. That's when you get to the next level of theological discussions there.
All right. Here's another one for you. Why do we believe in the... Why don't we believe in the four other archangels that the Orthodox accept?
So I wasn't aware that there was a difference here in the names of the archangels between the Catholic Communion and the Eastern churches. I do know that some of the Eastern churches accept Third Maccabees as canonical, whereas the Catholics don't. But I'm not aware, I don't recall of any archangels mentioned in there. So in other words, I don't know where this is coming from. Okay. I'm not aware of there being a difference here.
All right. Okay. I got one. I got another one for you here. I have a friend. Mm-hmm. I have a friend who is the daughter of an Orthodox mother and a Catholic father. She professes to be both. I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. Is this possible?
Well, it depends on what we mean by Orthodox here, right? Because there's a sense in which we can talk about Orthodox in union with Rome, Eastern Catholics. There's a sense in which we can't speak of that. It depends on what we mean by Orthodox here. So if what we mean by Orthodox is a denial of papal infallibility, a denial of papal supremacy, a denial of the orthodoxy of the doctrine of the Filioque, can you be Orthodox and still fully Catholic? No, if that's what you mean by Orthodox. But if you mean by Orthodox, one who is preserving the Eastern tradition, which does include the Filioque, the papacy, then we can speak about Orthodox in communion with Rome, if that's what we're referring to. So it all hinges on what do we mean here by Orthodox? Are we defining it as contrary to the dogmas of the Catholic Church, or as saying, no, the Eastern tradition actually preserves these doctrines in the Eastern tradition? In that sense, then we could speak of orthodoxy in union with Rome.
All right, you do so much of this, and as obviously that's why so many of the questions have to do with orthodoxy. I'm gonna end with kind of a dumb question, because I'm not bright on all of this. Since the time of Pope Paul VI and the period after the Second Vatican Council, when there were certain healings between the Orthodox and Catholics. Mm-hmm. Have things gotten better? Like, I think just the basic person wants to know, are we moving towards a healing of the rift, or are we kind of stuck?
Depends on what part of the world we're referring to. In reality, where not necessarily online, in reality, with real people and the way people actually are in real life,
yeah.
I think things are getting better on the whole. But on the internet, the schism is still just as bad as it was.
All right. Isn't that something?
So I think that, again, among the leadership in Orthodoxy and in the Catholic Church, things are certainly getting better and we're working towards reunion. But you still have a lot of people online and on the lay level who are holding fast to schism in their heart. And that's unfortunate. But that's what has continued the schism, unfortunately. It's kind of on the lay level.
That is unfortunate. Well, we'll pray for an end to that. We'll pray for the unity of the church that Christ himself prayed for, that it be in the real world and maybe even in the online world. Michael Lofton, thank you so much for taking time out of your Christmas season to spend 2 hours with us.
Thank you for having me. It was an honor.
Michael Lofton, you can find him at Reason and Theology. Please do find him there. Darren, do we know who's on tomorrow, or is it just a... Oh, we got Carlo. We got 2 hours with Carlo. We're going to do... we should do International Open Forum. Oh, I'm so looking forward to that. International Open Forum, also referred to around here as a lot of questions from the Philippines. We'll see you tomorrow, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Live.